Are there any questions so far?
No?
No?
Not sure, not a question. Yeah, that's the trouble. So it's similar to your question yesterday. I'm trying to remember your question yesterday to tell.
Well, yesterday we talked about the object being aliveness and curious about the subject.
Yeah, no. Yeah, sort of. It's good that you asked this question. So yesterday Melissa asked about, in the connected movement practice, noticing that happening in the mind where we nearly continuously experience ourselves as being watched and judged. And moving together, when people usually have their eyes closed, we can start to get a reality check to notice that we're actually not being watched. We're doing something that feels exposing culturally, but no one's actually looking at us. And so we can actually take it as an event in our own mind and a habit of our own mind. And then letting that be on the side and still allowing movement, still allowing kind of exposure or vulnerability and action, life. And her question yesterday was, but what else is there? Partly because that's such a strong habit, it does take up most of the room in the house. But also because what's left is less like the objects that we're used to. It's less like the experience we're used to having. It's much more subtle, and so it's ungraspable. Even though it's not the ungraspable, like even simple sense experience isn't really graspable, and we can't quite catch it. And this is one thing that's confusing when we start to notice our experience, because we assume it should be more firm and identifiable than it really is. And the gap between our classification and the actual experience can be disturbing and confusing. And so kind of admitting that our actual experience is much more slippery and indescribable. That's sort of what we said yesterday. One way to think of it is when we start to let our experience be itself, then something in us relaxes too, sometimes. When it's not scary, something can relax. And so then we don't need to be there. We are usually mostly the classifier, the describer, the judger. And so when there's less or no separation, less or no sense of separation, life is occurring. Life is kind of, it does seem to feel like it's rising up, bubbling up. And I think in our experience, we can't really say there's an observer and an object. Life is happening.
Because it feels a bit like an abyss.
It feels a bit like an abyss, yep. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
That's what people keep talking about.
And then the catch, and then the subject comes.
You got it. That's right. So again, it's great to notice that our experience is, it's a bit like an abyss. And that often fear comes when we notice or call it abyss, or even sometimes just the experience of bottomlessness. So it's important not to take the fear as wrong. It's totally natural. It's also totally, I sometimes differentiate between normal and natural. It's normal and natural. It's normal because we're afraid of, we're used to being afraid of anything we can't get, the unknown. And it's natural because biologically we are geared to be afraid of the unknown. So if we can let the fear be and still not let the fear decide for us. And that can be a little gritty sometimes, a little gritty, a little gristly. To let the fear be but not let it decide. We would usually want to go with one or the other, like kill the fear or get away from the abyss. So. And then we can find out what happens. Because after a while we start to notice that it's not like the experience of abyss goes away. Like, when we open to our experience, it's there. And we can pretend it's not there, but eventually we start to realize we'd rather not pretend. So giving that some time to settle down. And then noticing, maybe even being open to other words can be important. Calling it the abyss calls upon our hero and our victim and these kind of roles. And so what else do you experience in that? A bit like an abyss thing.
Dissolution,
yeah. For example, it's great to hear your experience now and keep on. So dissolution of... Okay, not so bad.
No, but then the eye keeps on coming back.
Yeah.
Don't let go.
Yeah, of course. So just, it's simple. Sorry to use that word again. If it can be not a big deal that the ego dissolves and comes back, and it starts to let you be in a place that can be okay with ego and not ego, but it does appreciate the of the dissolving as well as the reaction to noticing dissolving. Sometimes there's dissolving without noticing, and then it can get a little wider, so to speak. And then the panic. But not to kind of put our face in it, like how people train dogs, toilet train dogs, like putting their nose in caca. Like not sticking your nose in the abyss, kind of like get over it. I think because it is so real and delicate, there is a tendency to go for something easier. And so one of the easier things is to set up this kind of cartoon-like scenario where I'm on the edge of the abyss and I've got to jump, that kind of thing. And it's not like that. What it's like is that we're already, there's one really beautiful teaching that I mentioned yesterday from Hungary where they talked about the creative rest and the restful action. They also talk about the human being as being the bridge, who our place is as a bridge over the abyss, like that's our throne is the abyss. And that when we're in our place that the visible and invisible are connected. So it's not just my ego dissolving, but so we start to notice that we can't really escape that abyss. We don't have to jump into it. We already are there. So a lot of gentleness with the tendency to want to get away from where we are. Just a lot of gentleness with that conniving and fearful.
Also the name of the eye that's sort of is dust to watch, which feels different to the eye that hears sound or what is thinking. It's a different eye than the thinker. It feels different. It still feels subject, but it feels a different subject.
And when you name it, what happens? Okay. Could you hear that?
Then I start to think, what's witness?
Yeah.
What is that concept of, what does it mean to witness?
Yeah. Just a little more confidence in your own experiencing. But really gentleness and forgiveness with the tendency to turn to someone else's concept for refuge. Then you'll have your whole energy for what's happening. There's a quotation, another one from Krishnamurti from talks in the 1940s that he gave that's on the subject that I had for the talk today. The very desire for a method, this very idea of getting a method, destroys your freedom of action, which is the very freedom of life itself. So he's a little extreme and a little negative sometimes, Krishnamurti, because somehow we have to start somewhere. And I've personally been really helped by techniques that other people have told me how to do. And then letting them take me somewhere. But it is an important thing that we don't talk about much. How to go from when you have gotten what you need to get from that technique to life itself. So this is a subtle version of that. Well, at least we can mention, because it is the part where it's like, now see, let's go on, what's going to happen? It's your discovery. There's not a script. And the lovely possibility that each our own discoveries are also kind of feeding back. So we've received a lot from other people's experience and teachings, and in the ways that we let ourselves step onto the unknown territory that calls us, that seems to be where we need to be, in the subtle and in the outer, in all the different ways that we step out of following someone else. Following someone else's rules and copying out of insecurity. Any moment of that stepping out is a powerful giving to all of us, I think. Even if it doesn't become a technique that you tell someone about. Melissa's question also brings up a curious subject of then what can we learn from others? What can we learn from others that's not just about the kind of projection onto the higher being, like in the quotation yesterday from Adam Smith, where the poor person saw people with money and then interpreted poverty as inferior and having wealth as superior. Projection onto someone who has something that we don't. Projection onto our not having as something lower. So how could we learn from each other without, what is there left that's not all that projection stuff? What's left of teaching and learning? And one of my favorite descriptions of what a teacher is from Chögyam Trungpa. He says, the teacher is who leads us into the desert of egolessness. And again, he also has a certain kind of sense of humor. That he likes to emphasize the extreme sometimes. Like he's giving an extremely unromantic definition of teacher to help us get over our fantasy of teacher-student connection. So then we can get over, like, be shocked out of our fantasy, our illusion, and then, what did he say? The teacher leads us into the desert of egolessness. So I don't like the word ego and egolessness. I don't always know what people mean by that. I think it's used kind of very loosely. So maybe we could use the word openness, leads us into the desert of openness, where we don't take, there's not any ideas to take shelter in. Krishnamurti gives a good description of openness, but as often he gives it in a negative way. he talks about closedness. So he says, imagine there's someone who has class prejudice, which is a good example to use in India, with their history of British rule to start with, most recently, and then the caste system before that. And he just makes a simple example of someone, any of us, we have our prejudices. So with prejudice, we come into a room or situation, and we're not aware of our prejudice often. We're not quite willing to admit. It would be embarrassing to think of ourselves as prejudiced. So we don't think that thought. We kind of block out our knowing of us in that subtle way, where we could be aware of prejudice in us. So we're unaware of the prejudice, and we can't meet life, we can't meet any situation openly, freely, and simply. And his suggestion is just being allowed to be aware of prejudice and how it stops us from meeting life openly, freely, and simply. I like that. It's a very simple whole kind of picture of us. It also allows us to be ready to start now, instead of this idea that we kind of need to root out all of our prejudice and then we could begin to be a nice person. But we could already wholeheartedly now be open to the inner field to notice where there's prejudice, where there's pre-judgment, where the judgment's already happened before anything else can happen. And to notice what happens when we don't notice our prejudice. I have a friend, actually I just realized, she came to my mind this morning, I just only realized right now that she's Australian, but I know her from India where she mostly lives. And she was visiting Lucknow where I was living And she was visiting also to meet one of my teachers, Poonjaji, that we called Papaji. It's like calling him granddad or something like that. And he was a very curious guy, very much not the picture of the enlightened being, with his tattoos and his dentures and his love of sweets, despite his diabetes. And he also loved mangoes, and it was mango season when Heather came, which means it was hot, so it's not hard to be in a bad mood when it's that hot. And she was invited into his dining room, Papaji's dining room, and there were some people around the table, dining table, anglicized dining table. And Papaji was going through a bowl of mangoes and very carefully choosing really nice ones and giving them to this person, this person. And Heather was sitting there like, I really want a mango. Why doesn't he give me a mango? And Heather is one of the most perceptive people I know. She's incredibly sensitive and able to receive people as they are. But sometimes that gift gets in her way. Receiving people as they are and seeing everything, sometimes you can start to focus on the negative and get into your judging and prejudice. So that's what happened that day. Maybe it was too hot. And everyone else at the table had received a mango except for her, and it wasn't that big of a table, like six people maybe. And still she didn't get her mango, and she was really churning. And you can really see how she's right, of course. Why doesn't she get a mango? Everyone else is getting a mango. And finally, he's very naughty. He finally gave her a mango. And it was a rotten mango. And it was the kind of way that he would hand it to her, not quite winking, but with that kind of, look at what you're doing, girl. What's more important? The mango or freedom or happiness. This was a teacher that people went to for a hit of enlightenment, basically. And we were talking about ultimate freedom all the time, but this kind of situation happened all the time, where you would be wanting the mango and getting into a bad mood about not getting the mango. The great thing about Heather is that she really got it. It wasn't just like, it didn't leave her sour. She was able to laugh about it. And that's a gift that I wish for all of us, that we could be in a bad mood and we end up getting the rotten mango or no mango. No mango and then the rotten mango. And that then we could get it, we could get the joke and we could laugh about it. I mentioned this morning Brené Brown, who talks about shame and freedom from shame, which I'm really glad that she does, because I think that shame is one of the real clues or keys to our happiness. So unlocking shame, practicing with a lot of forgiveness that it's probably going to come back, but noticing shame and letting it, lifting it off the heart. So Brené Brown, I think she's like a social scientist, I think. And she's studied shame in people. And she studied people who are living wholeheartedly people who are living with joy, who don't have so much the burden of shame. And what she noticed about those people, the way she tells it, is that they can tell their life story without holding back. Could tell their life story without holding back. Whatever may have happened is not the most important thing. Whatever you did wrong, or whatever wrong happened to you, or whatever went on in your mind or your body, doesn't kick you out. And even if I say that and we hear it and we know, yeah, of course, anything could go through your mind, anything could happen to your body, and it doesn't kick you out. It's not the most important thing. However wonderful or terrible. Whether you did it or somebody else. It sounds like something we could agree with, but if we really let that kind of land in our lap for a moment, that there's nothing that could happen in your mind or in your body, from inside or from outside, you or anybody else, that could be more important than what you already have, what you already are. Letting it land in our lap would allow us to have a different perspective on our whole culture and society. And another great idea from Krishnamurti, that again, it's something that I've been thinking about a lot for the last few months, and to finally find someone else speaking about it, this is where someone else's idea, not quite as refuge, but like, yes, this is really, isn't it obvious? Someone's asking him about social work, and Krishnamurti's saying, yeah, it's true that now, in the state of things as they are, there are people who need to clean up after our mess, to take care of people who don't have enough resources to take care of themselves. But he says there must also be those who work to prevent the new structures of society from being based on false ideas. And I know, because Holly, who was sick and had to leave, was doing some help with some elections, that you have elections happening around the place. So it's probably too late for these elections, maybe, but the possibility of probably a different kind of government, actually, where there's a place for people who are looking out for false ideas and structures based on false ideas, and how that harms people, how that sets us up for suffering. To prevent the new structures of society from being based on false ideas. Isn't that a good idea? And as always, when I talk about something outer, I'm also talking about the inner. So however old your habits that are painful, however old those habits are, however old the wounds are, however deep, we could make room for some activity of life, some feeling for what are false ideas and what are structures, so ideals that you're living by, what are structures, what are rules that are based on false ideas that are hurting you and causing you to hurt. They're setting you up to suffer. And what would be a place to come from that could prevent new structures in your life from being based on false ideas? It won't come from the idea realm. That would just be a loud conversation. It won't come from the wound. It won't come from when we're trapped in the damaging habit. There's a great concept in Indian spirituality called sanskar, which doesn't mean construction or formation, that also constructs and forms. So we've been shaped by forces in our lives, and so it's not surprising, for example, that our mind is busy and going out often, because that's the training the mind has had. It's not surprising that the body doesn't want to stay still at first, because that's the training we've had. So these are two examples of generally forces that have acted on us and shaped us. And then the shape that we've landed in from those forces also has an effect. It has an effect then, an ongoing effect. It also shapes around and within. But just like the sandy bottom of the ocean, it's also not too hard to change the forces that are impacting and change the shape that would then change the shape. So if we could especially feel for shame as a structure that we live by, that we've learned, that we've accepted. And to check whether shame is based on a true idea or a false idea. So we're not ruling out regret. We're not ruling out sadness when we realize we've hurt ourselves or another. We're not ruling out sorrow when we discover that we've been wasting our lives. There's a lot of room for that. A lot of room for a relatively short period of time is enough. In those shocking moments, usually shocking moments of discovery, that we've been living according to rules that are based on false ideas, we're discovering that we've been wasting our time and our energy and our life. And it's sad. Not because it's my fault, though. Not because I did it wrong. It happened that way naturally. But it's still sad. That kind of sadness has an aliveness to it that actually guides and leads somewhere, rather than the shame kind of turning in on itself, trapping our energy. Sadness in the discovery of what we've missed, what we haven't allowed ourselves to notice and know, understandably, but still, allows an opening out from under the burden of the prejudice. Are there questions yet? Or comments? Great.
So my mind, I guess, oscillates around sometimes things like that. But I sit day after day after day after day. Maybe it goes back to the beginning of not having a method. I suppose I'm just actually checking if this is okay. But can you just, like, is it fine to just try and sit there, which I've been doing for years, just sit there and empty my mind?
Just sit there and what?
And empty my mind.
Can you empty your mind?
No.
Okay. So what do you actually do? Your idea is that you should empty your mind? Is that correct?
What I actually do is go through, I guess, different methods, but I don't have a... I suppose I'm asking if I need... If you think it would be helpful to have a logical progression of different things to try
at
the time.
Yes, but which logic is that? That's what we have to discover.
Yeah.
So we want to go by a preformed, prefabricated logic that we adopt. And that does not work. It can work. I seem to notice that allowing a technique to come into my life, partly through my looking for it and receiving it, and then adapting it rather than adopting it, giving it enough time that I, to the best of my ability, am with the fullness of the technique. For example, the loving kindness practice, which has so many layers. So what we did today was pretty different from how it might often, how I would usually lead it, in fact. And then to be open to notice, it would be like if that's a like a tree, and it starts to branch out, and we get maybe a sense of having pretty full experience of that technique. And then it kind of branches out again, or maybe some other metaphor, like some birds come or whatever. And if we could not ignore that branch just popped out over there, and being with the fullness of that, so including what we got with the technique and realizing we are leaving the territory of the technique over here, and it's okay. It's actually required of us in a way. It's needed.
When you say things like mastering the technique or...
I didn't say that.
Sorry.
To the best of our ability, getting a sense of...
But even getting a sense of that tree, I suppose, I find it very difficult to know.
Okay.
Should I be sticking with this one?
That's right. It's hard to know.
Adapting this one?
That's right. It's really hard to know. Okay. I don't know if I totally believe what you're saying, reporting about your experience, but if it's true, you need a different technique. But it partly may have to do with that you have already this preformed idea that you're supposed to empty your mind. Then we can also say it can take years to discover your way. And some things that have helped me are noticing what's joyful. And maybe what has always been joyful. There might be something newly joyful, and that could be like circulation just opened up in your left arm, and there was maybe such a no on certain areas that we couldn't enjoy it, even if it was really for us. Joyful. And then when there is some calm with receptivity, so not like enforced calm, not busy calm, a memory may come. And I told the story yesterday of the Buddha when this happened to him and the memory that came to him. So his memory came from his childhood. So don't be surprised and don't feel that it's a poverty if it has to be from that long ago. Landing just lightly now. And it does have a different quality. And if there's a kind of calm that is peaceful calm, not busy calm, then it's almost like it lands in a lake without a ripple but goes right to the bottom, to your core. And it's still easy to dismiss. And so then there might come another clue, which could be a coincidence. So joyful, a memory may come within the calm mind. It could be instead of a memory, an image, or whatever way your mind works. Sorry, my mind is visual, obviously. Something could come into the calm mind that's not a memory that lands in that way. And still we dismiss it. The dismissing would often have a quality of, oh no, that's too silly, childish, it's not in the books. And even if we hear ourselves thinking that, we still think it, we still believe it's a correct thing to say, no, out of the embarrassment, shame factor. I wouldn't want to be caught doing that. Then so joyful, in the calm, some impression, whether memory or otherwise. And then coincidence might start to help, triangulate, kind of, that you're getting from this side and this side. This really brings that, and still resistance might be there. And if we build up pressure that we've got to get through the resistance, we know what happens. The resistance is always going to be stronger. So you can also think of anything that you love to do that you never get around to doing, almost ever. Like what?
Swimming.
Okay. Tell me about swimming, when you swim. Don't tell me how rarely you do it, just when you swim.
Well, it's like meditation. It's like great meditation. It's just...
In what way?
It's presence. Well, I think
what does presence feel like?
I just feel. Mm-hmm.
What I find helpful is practicing love in the Buddhist tradition, starting with oneself. In whatever way you can. So it might be a few gestures a day of loving gestures to you. If it wants to go to Melissa or the kids or whoever, like, let it. It's not a strict rule. But also let it go to Ruff. And then that it starts to make it easier that you might think of going swimming. And then being in an environment where Melissa says, why don't you go swimming? Now. Mm-hmm. I got the kids. We're going to go jump on the trampolines at that trampoline place. Why don't you go swimming? Not too much pressure in case she gets back and you didn't go or whatever. Pressure would just make the resistance stronger and make it into something it isn't. But just the kind of, I remember with one of my teachers, in the afternoon after lunch, I would have my list of things to do, and he would just say, why don't you just take a short nap before you go? And it would be really hot, usually. And so it was a little easier, maybe, than whatever you have to do to get to swim. Mm-hmm. Just lie down after lunch for 20 minutes, which would then change my list considerably. But it was surprising how many times that had to happen before I would be the one to say, I can just take a little 20-minute rest before. And it may also be surprising that the 20-minute rest didn't always become an hour. Sometimes it needed to be an hour, but sometimes it would be 2 minutes, and it would be enough, and the next thing would happen. One of the excuses that we have for not doing what we love to do where that happens is that false idea that it would be like indulging something that would then make indulgence take over our life. But in experience, it's not that way. I'm just trying to think of something that is like a step towards swimming, but swimming's a unless you have a pool, it's a little closer. Yes, please.
I suppose it feels, I feel a bit reductive when I sit every morning. When I'm quite lucky, there's lots of joyous moments in my life that I can reach for as a a pleasant state to sort of.
Right.
I sort of feel like, shouldn't it be a bit more?
Yeah, it should.
Yeah.
It can be. Yeah. Another way to go is a little bit putting you on the spot, and that would be like, are you ready for meditation to be that juicy and inexplicable, unpredictable? Sometimes you planned it to be half an hour and it's an hour. And sometimes you plan for it to be half an hour and you were ready for your juice and it's 2 minutes. That's just a small taste of. So just what I'm trying to do is help you feel the resistance to that, where you're kind of comfortable with checking off sitting today. Right? And where something else that's more subtle, and so it's been getting squashed, is ready to play. And knows that it's not like playing in a flippant sense, but it's much more exacting and demanding, even if it's playful. This is what we don't like. Usually we like to hear about playfulness and juiciness, but that it actually brings out our precision and our willingness to be stretched, to go beyond our ideas. And sometimes when we go beyond our ideas, we do start to kind of get lost, and we need to come back to an idea of sitting every day. But with that mischievous, like Papaji, can you imagine being willing to not give someone a mango and then give them a rotten mango? I'm not saying you should, but the willingness to be mischievous when it might bring out what's important. To be rude. I'm not saying to be rude, but to go against the ideas. How are we going? Maybe I'll just give another example of someone finding their way, which wasn't sitting. It's a woman named Terry Tempest Williams, and her thing is basically nature. Anything in nature. Sentient and insentient. And she notices in herself and in people in general a loneliness born of disconnection, where we have naturally a pull to connect. We're made to connect. And we live in more and kind of increasing isolation, usually. Luckily, not everyone, but. And what for her is important is being out in the land with other. For her, the experience of she talks about seeing a group of, I think they were sea lions or elephant seals, I can't remember which one. Maybe elephant seals, so this bulky creatures who are so graceful in the water. And just sensing this whole culture happening among these creatures. And being enormously touched by that in a way that sounds like it expanded her world, in the sense of expanded her. But she calls it other, so it's a little bit different language. To experience what isn't going by our little limited ideas in life going on with a kind of grace, however foreign to our logic. She says that being out in the land with other, anything that's alive is what she means. Actually, not even what we think of as alive. Nature. Then we remember where the source of our power lies. So she's telling her experience and what might happen for you, what might not happen for you. Being out in the land with other, we remember, she remembers, where the source of her power lies, that it doesn't lie in the idea. It doesn't lie in the prejudice. It doesn't lie in my expectation of my meditation, which is what the trickiness is. How do I know what is like a pull into a new realm of meditation and what is imposing an expectation that my meditation should be different? What is sensing dryness in meditation? And then, like we did in the meditation, sensing dryness means knowing juiciness is possible. And how that's different from an idea of juiciness that I then require, demand from my meditation, expect from my meditation, or project onto my meditation, pretend to be having. Unfortunately, the pretend part we do sometimes. But for her, being out in the land with other, remembering the source of this, where the source of our power lies, the source of our power lies. So it's coming out of what we talked about yesterday, the sense that having less is necessarily inferior. So seeing myself as having less, being from a poor family, assuming that those who have more are superior, and that I should leave what I have to copy them. We get out of that mode. Being out, touched by what seems to be other, but then we're touched in a way that connects us to the source of our power. So it's not so other after all. It brings us back home. So just read to close a few lines from a poem by another poem, like yesterday, by Mary Oliver, called What Is There Beyond Knowing? That I think speaks to Ralph's situation also. What is there beyond knowing that keeps calling to me? I can't turn in any direction, but it's there. And I like how this line can be heard in a couple of different ways. I can't turn in any direction, but it's there. Could be anywhere I turn, it's there. But it could also be, I can't turn in any direction, but it's there, kind of anyway. I can't find it in a particular direction. And that's one of the problems. It's so subtle. It's not what we're kind of looking for, what we... need isn't really locatable, just like even a body sensation isn't quite pinned downable. So much more so, something more subtle, like how your path is evolving. You can't quite turn in a direction to feel how it's branched out and pin it down and say, this is my new technique, chapter 2. I can't turn in any direction, but it's there. I don't mean the leaves grip and shine, or even the thrush's silk song, but the far-off fires, for example, of the stars, heaven's slowly turning theater of light, or the wind playful with its breath, or time that's always rushing forward, standing still in the same, what shall I say, moment. What is there beyond knowing that still can call to us? That in one way I can turn in any direction and it's there, and in another way, no matter where I turn, if I turn in a direction, it's not there, but it's there anyway. How what seems to be other can bring us home. What seems to be outside of my possibilities the calling towards what's possible. What's most intimate in one. So yesterday I called the talk, which was on a similar subject, The Unattainable, and I never really went back to the title to tell you why I chose that title. And it's partly this, partly we can't grasp it, we can't get it in the way that we expect ourselves to. And anything that we could get in the way we expect ourselves to doesn't do it for us. It's not satisfying. Just like the poor man, when he finally, after a life's labor, gets wealthy, it's not better than the contentment that was available all along, that could have been. And also unattainable in the sense of it's already here. We could call it something else, that we keep dismissing it. Dismissible, undismissable. Even though we keep dismissing it, the suggestion keeps coming. Possibility keeps on. So we have time for simple human walking on the earth, inside or outside, whatever feels juicy.